Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is. I'm Ana Mateo in Washington. Parents all around the world want the best for their children, especially when it comes to education. In the second part of our show, we will hear whether being surrounded by a foreign language, or immersed in it, is the best way to learn a language. Or are traditional lectures with grammar rules and vocabulary lists the best way to learn to speak like a native? But first, we hear about an educational model that is gaining popularity around the world. The goal of the International Baccalaureate Organization, or IB, is to create students of the world. The International Baccalaureate Organization was founded in 1968 in Geneva, Switzerland. The IB organization works with schools in 147 countries to offer programs for students 3 to 19 years old. These programs, it says, help to develop the intellectual, personal, emotional, and social skills to live, learn, and work in a rapidly globalizing world. The organization says that IB programs are in nearly 3,800 schools worldwide. The majority of these schools offer IB diploma programs. High school students have to complete 6 courses, pass exams, and write a 20-page paper to earn an IB diploma. And schools accepted into the IB program are expected to walk the walk and not just talk the talk. Students are given opportunities to attend events that open their eyes to a larger world. There are IB workshops and conferences held all over the world. One such event was a 5-day conference at the University of British Columbia in Canada. The conference was called The New Sustainability, Making Things Better, Not Just Less Bad. 300 students from 13 countries attended. One of the speakers was Drew Deutsch, director of IB Americas. He says the conference was meant for students to not only learn about the environment, but also to become more international in their thinking and develop lasting relationships.
We want to send the students back to their schools to highlight issues surrounding protecting the environment, but also make sure that these students become more students of the world and that they form bonds with peers their own age from around the world. And obviously with social networking and the tools that are available to students today, we expect that they will have formed these bonds really for life.
17-year-old Itzel Chavez was one of the 21 IB students who received scholarships to attend the conference.
I really wanted to go, so I applied for a scholarship and I had to write an essay. And in my school, they chose one person and I got chosen for the scholarship, so I got to go.
I'm Ana Mateo, and you are listening to As It Is. We just heard how schools around the world are working with the International Baccalaureate Organization to make students of the world. One of the requirements of the IB program is to speak a second language. But what is the best way to learn a new language? Steve Ember has more on that topic.
What is the best way to learn a new language? A small study of foreign language learning in adults compared two methods. One is known as the explicit or classroom method. This is the kind of traditional classroom teaching where students are taught a lot of information about grammar rules. The other method is known as the implicit or immersion method. The idea here is to learn much the way children do when they learn a native language. That is, by being with native speakers and absorbing the language that surrounds them, generally without a lot of explanation. Teachers may combine these two methods into what Professor Michael Ullmann calls immersion-style classroom teaching. But is that necessarily a better way to learn a language? Mr. Ullmann was the senior investigator for the new study. He is a professor of neuroscience at Georgetown University Medical Center in Washington. He says he was surprised to find that combining the two methods might not help the brain in processing the new language.
You know, if my life were on the line and I had to learn a language, what would I do? I'm not sure. One possibility would be that start with explicit and then go to immersion, right? Start with classroom and then go to immersion. But there is this possibility that classroom could hurt later immersion. That's what, you know, one possibility of interpreting our data.
The Public Library of Science published the study earlier this year. The 21 adults in the experiment learned Brocanto 2, a 13-word language created for the study. The words and grammar rules relate to a computer game similar to chess that the learners played. For example, Blom Nimo Lu Nip Li Praz means the square Blom piece switches with the Nip piece. The researchers tested the people 3 to 6 months after they had learned the language to see how well they could remember it. The study found that those who had learned it with the immersion method had brainwaves similar to those of native speakers of a language when speaking that language. Professor Ullmann says those who trained with the classroom method also became more native-like in their brain processing, but only the immersion group showed full native-like processing of the grammar. Still, he says, teachers should be careful how they use the results of his study.
You know, I would not make any curriculum changes based on this. Nevertheless, it is suggestive, and I think it warrants further research to see whether, in fact, what kind of training might, in fact, be best, not just for reaching the native brain bases, but also for, you know, maximum proficiency in different aspects of language, like grammar, you know, syntax and lexicon. So I think further research is warranted. And it may be, for example, that a combination of classroom and immersion might be best. But we don't know that.
I'm Steve Ember.
And I'm Anna Mateo. While we wait for more research and studies to tell us the best way to become an expert in a language, just keep listening to VOA Learning English and find us on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter for more Learning English stories.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
For from VOA Learning English. This is In the News. Relations between China and Vietnam were tense this week because of Chinese activity in waters claimed by both sides. Chinese and Vietnamese ships have attacked each other since China deployed an oil rig in the South China Sea last month. In Vietnam, the area is known as the East Sea. The device was set up in an area that Vietnam says is within its exclusive economic zone. The deployment led to protests across the country. On Thursday, Vietnamese officials reported that one Chinese worker was killed after a protest at a steel factory turned violent. More than 100 other people were injured. The unrest came after thousands left their jobs and destroyed factories reportedly owned by Chinese. In southern Vietnam, up to 20,000 protesters burned buildings and attacked factories at Binh Duong, a major manufacturing center. A sign at the entrance to one factory said, "We are South Korean. No Chinese officials work at our company." Another sign showed a Japanese flag and the words, "We always support Vietnam." Government officials blamed what they called bad elements. They said most people condemned the violence. Officials in Cambodia said hundreds of Chinese nationals had crossed the border from Vietnam. In Beijing, the Chinese government expressed serious concern about the situation. A foreign ministry official urged Vietnam to punish those responsible for the violence. She appealed to the Vietnamese government to guarantee the security of Chinese companies and employees. Vietnamese Prime Minister Nguyen Tan Dung said anti-China protests to express patriotism or nationalism are legitimate, but he said those that violate laws and destroy foreign businesses would be strictly dealt with. Some observers questioned whether his statement came too late. Jonathan London is a professor with City University of Hong Kong.
So you have coverage of the dispute on the high seas, and you have coverage of the violence, but yet you don't have any reportage of what this means. What are Vietnamese authorities saying about this? What are we to make of these events? And so, you know, what the result is a very disjointed, you know, flow of information that does not contribute to a stable political environment.
China is Vietnam's biggest trading partner. Many observers fear that rising tensions could damage the Vietnamese economy. China and Vietnam are not the only nations with claims to parts of the South China Sea. Brunei, Malaysia, and the Philippines each claim all or part of the sea. Two island chains, the Paracels and the Spratlys, are said to contain oil and natural gas. The Philippines Department of National Defense accused China of developing land in the Spratlys. Edwin Lacierda is a spokesman for the president.
I would like to believe that China would like to be a member of the international community in good standing, that however, it appears that they are doing things which we find objectionable.
On Friday, more than 100 Filipinos and Vietnamese held a joint protest near the Chinese consulate in Manila. They demanded that China stop activities in areas claimed by their countries. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Pat Bodner.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Today, we tell a traditional American story called A Tall Tale. A Tall Tale is a story about a person who is larger than life. The descriptions in the story are exaggerated, much greater than in real life. Long ago, the people who settled in undeveloped areas of America first told tall tales. After a hard day's work, people gathered to tell each other stories. Each group of workers had its own tall tale hero. An African-American man named John Henry was the hero of former slaves and the people who built the railroads. He was known for his strength. Railroads began to link the United States together in the 19th century. The railroads made it possible to travel from one side of the country to the other in less than a week. Before then, the same trip might have taken up to 6 months. Railroad companies employed thousands of workers to create the smooth, flat pathways required by trains. John Henry was perhaps the most famous worker. He was born a slave in the southern United States. He became a free man as a result of America's Civil War. Then he worked for the railroads. Confirming details of John Henry's life is not possible. That is because no one knows for sure if he really lived. This is one of the things that makes his story interesting. However, John Henry is based in part on real events. Many people say he represents the spirit of growth in America during this period. Now, here is Shep O'Neill with our story.
People still talk about the night John Henry was born. It was dark and cloudy. Then, lightning lit up the night sky. John Henry's birth was a big event. His parents showed him to everyone they met. John Henry was the most powerful-looking baby people had ever seen. He had thick arms, wide shoulders, and strong muscles. John Henry started growing when he was 1 day old. He continued growing until he was the strongest man who ever lived. John Henry grew up in a world that did not let children stay children for long. One day, he was sitting on his father's knee. The boy picked up a small piece of steel and a workman's tool, a hammer. He looked at the two objects, then said, "A hammer will be the death of me." Before John Henry was 6 years old, he was carrying stones for workers building a nearby railroad. By the age of 10, he worked from early in the morning until night. Often, he would stop and listen to the sound of a train far away. He told his family, "I am going to be a steel driver someday." Steel drivers helped create pathways for the railroad lines. These laborers had the job of cutting holes in rock. They did this by hitting thick steel drills, or spikes. By the time John Henry was a young man, he was one of the best steel drivers in the country. He could work for hours without missing a beat. People said he worked so fast that his hammer moved like lightning. John Henry was almost 2 meters tall. He weighed more than 90 kilograms. He had a beautiful, deep voice and played an instrument called a banjo. John Henry married another steel driver, a woman named Polly Ann. They had a son. John Henry went to work as a steel driver for the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad, or C&O. The company asked him to lead workers on a project to extend the railroad into the Allegheny Mountains. The workers made good progress on the project until they started working near Big Bend Mountain in West Virginia. The company's owners said the mountain was too big to build a railroad around it, so the workers were told they had to force their drills through it. This meant creating a tunnel more than 1.5 kilometers long. The project required about 1,000 laborers and lasted 3 years. Pay was low and the work was difficult. The workers had to breathe thick black smoke and dust. Hundreds of men became sick. Many died. John Henry was the strongest and fastest man involved in the project. He used a hammer that weighed more than 6 kilograms. Some people say he was able to cut a path of 3 to 6 meters a day. That July was the hottest month ever in West Virginia. Many workers became tired and weak in the heat. John Henry was concerned his friends might lose their jobs, so he picked up their hammers and began doing their work. 1 week, he did his own work and that of several other steel drivers. He worked day and night, rarely stopping to eat. The men thanked John Henry for his help. He just smiled and said, "A man ain't nothing but a man. He has just got to do his best." The extreme heat continued for weeks. One day, a salesman came to the work area with a new drilling machine powered by steam. He said it could drill holes faster than 12 men working together. The railroad company planned to buy the machine if it worked as well as the salesman said. The supervisor of the workers dismissed the salesman's claims. He said, "I have the best steel driver in the country. His name is John Henry, and he can beat more than 20 men working together." The salesman disputed the statements. He said the company could have the machine without cost if John Henry was faster. The supervisor called to John Henry. He said, "This man does not believe that you can drill faster. How about a race?" John Henry looked at the machine and saw images of the future. He saw machines taking the place of America's best laborers. He saw himself and his friends unemployed and standing by a road, asking for food. He saw men losing their families and their rights as human beings. John Henry told the supervisor he would never let the machine take his job. His friends all cheered. However, John Henry's wife, Polly Ann, was not happy. Competing against the machine will be the death of you, she said. You have a wife and a child. If anything happens to you, we will not ever smile again. John Henry lifted his son into the air. He told his wife, a man ain't nothing but a man. But a man always has to do his best. Tomorrow, I will take my hammer and drive that steel faster than any machine. On the day of the big event, many people came to Big Bend Mountain to watch. John Henry and the salesman stood side by side. Even early in the day, the sun was burning hot. The competition began. John Henry kissed his hammer and started working. At first, the steam-powered drill worked 2 times faster than he did. Then he started working with a hammer in each hand. He worked faster and faster. In the mountain, the heat and dust were so thick that most men would have had trouble breathing. The crowd shouted as clouds of dust came from inside the mountain. The salesman was afraid when he heard what sounded like the mountain breaking. However, it was only the sound of John Henry at work. Polly Ann and her son cheered when the machine was pulled from the tunnel. It had broken down. Polly Ann urged John Henry to come out, but he kept working faster and faster. He dug deep into the darkness, hitting the steel so hard that his body began to fail him. He became weak, and his heart burst. John Henry fell to the ground. There was a terrible silence. Polly Ann did not move, because she knew what happened. John Henry's blood spilled over the ground, but he still held one of the hammers. I beat them, he said. His wife cried out, don't go, John Henry. Bring me a cool drink of water, he said. Then he took his last breath. Friends carried his body from the mountain. They buried him near the house where he was born. Crowds went there after they heard about John Henry's death. Soon, the steam drill and other machines replaced the steel drivers. Many laborers left their families looking for work. They took the only jobs they could find. As they worked, some sang about John Henry.
John Henry told his captain, man ain't nothing but a man. And before I let the steel drill beat me down, I'm gonna die with this hammer in my hand, Lord, Lord.
You have just heard the story of John Henry. It was adapted for Special English by George Grove. Your storyteller was Shep O'Neill. Join us again next week for another American story in Special English on The Voice of America. This is Faith Lapidus.
Shaker, why don't you?